is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Marilyn Cochran-Smith, the John E. Cawthorn Professor of Teacher Education for Urban Schools at the Lynch School of Education at Boston College. Our conversation will focus on an investigation that she and her colleagues have been engaged in with regard to teacher education accountability over the past few years. Their work has resulted in a book entitled Reclaiming Accountability in Teacher Education that will be published towards the end of April by Teachers College Press. Welcome, Marilyn.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
When people talk about teacher education accountability and making teacher education accountable, what are they referring to?
Well, I think what most people are referring to is sort of a three-part logic. First is the assumption that teacher quality in the U.S. isn't what it ought to be. And they refer to things like students' low performance on international comparisons and the persistent existence of the so-called achievement gap. So we've got that idea first. Teacher quality isn't good. And then second, teachers are the most important factor in students' achievement. And low-income schools or schools with lots of students in minoritized groups are the least likely to get good teachers. So if we don't have the kind of quality of teaching that we want, and teachers are the most important factor in students' achievement, teacher education becomes very, very important. And the logic continues with this. So we need to hold teacher education accountable. We need to make sure that teacher education quality is improved or high enough so that it can increase teacher quality so we can solve the problem of low student achievement. And so we want teacher education to be accountable for outcomes. And when people say outcomes, they usually mean students' achievement, but they also might mean the retention of teachers or the desire of teachers to teach in low-income or other schools with lots of minoritized student population. So generally, that's what people are referring to. We want to hold teacher education accountable, not for inputs. And when they say that, people usually mean not for the qualifications of the teacher education faculty, not for the kinds of courses that are taught and the way courses address standards, but we want to hold teacher education accountable for outcomes. And as I said, by that they mean usually students' achievement, teacher retention, and sometimes teacher performance as well on various kinds of assessments.
What's the history of this accountability paradigm, and what seems to lie behind it?
Well, it's an interesting history, I think, and it has to do with the gradual shift over at least the last 50 years to what many people now refer to as a knowledge economy. And this is true in the U.S., but it's true in many, many places around the world in almost every developed or developing country. So we've had this shift from an industrial society to a knowledge society. This has brought with it a shift to neoliberal economics, which, as is generally known now, I think, means lots of focus on human capital, encouragement of competition among schools, more and more efforts to privatize various aspects of education. With teacher education in particular, this means alternative routes and the encouragement of alternative routes into teaching and new providers of teacher preparation. This also means, in general, the encouragement of charter schools. So this idea that the economy is linked to teacher quality, which is what I was talking about with the first question. So the history is this widespread assumption that the health of a nation's economy depends on the quality of its education system, and in particular, on the quality of its teachers, which, as I said in response to your first question, depends on teacher education. So it's, again, it's this multi-part logic that begins with a concern about the economic health of the nation, and based on a series of assumptions, which all of which are arguable, ends up with the key factor being teachers, and the key factor in influencing how good teachers are being teacher education. So I think that's obviously a very abbreviated version of what the history is.
Much of this really began in the 1980s with the report, The Nation at Risk, that really kind of pointed to the possibility that the United States was kind of experiencing economic competition from Germany and Japan at that point because of what were seen as superior schools in those countries. How would you actually call into question that particular argument with regard to the link between education and the economy?
Well, I mean, this, all of these questions obviously demand much more lengthy answers, but I think many people have pointed out that the quality of our economy, the health and robustness of the national economy in any country, depends on a whole lot of things, not just on the quality of the education system. It also depends on trade policies. We can see that what's going on today in the news. It also depends on what else the country is spending money on, wars, aggressions across the globe. It has to do with internal policies about production in the country. So it's not to say that education and the quality of education systems isn't part of the health of the nation. But the questioning that many people have done, myself included, and my colleagues who worked on this book with me included, we question the fact that the assumption is that teacher quality is the key determinant of the economic health of the nation, because that just ignores so many other things. For example, poverty, systemic racism, the structures that produce and reproduce inequalities in the country. So there's been a wealth of critique from many different angles about this set of assumptions. But that hasn't changed the fact that they continue to be widely accepted, and they have become what some critics have called part of our common sense. So we're not even aware often that these are assumptions we're making, and that different assumptions could be made, and that various critiques have been made. It's just that these things have been repeated so many times that they become sort of normalized into everyday conversations about schools and education and teachers.
So what are some of the ways these assumptions and this vision of teacher education accountability have been manifested over the past few decades?
So let me just talk about the U.S., and that's really what the focus of our book is. But as I said, there are also very interesting things going on in many parts of the world, and reforming teacher education, either through accountability systems or some other approaches, is something that's happening in many, many places. But in the U.S., I think the major ways these things have been manifested is in the emergence of multiple overlapping and sometimes competing accountability initiatives that are layered onto one another and coexisting. And let me give you a few examples, and this is going to be a little bit of alphabet soup, so I'll explain what I'm talking about. So, for example, in 2016, at the very end of President Obama's administration, there were new interpretations of the Title II requirements of the Higher Education Act. It turns out that these requirements were rescinded by Donald Trump once he was in office, just in a few months after he entered office. But those Title II regulations would have required teacher education programs to be evaluated by states according to the impact of graduates of teacher education programs on their eventual students in classrooms. That's one example of an accountability initiative or an accountability system or even part of an accountability regime. One other example is the new requirements, the new standards and requirements of CAPE, which is the Council for the Accreditation of Educator Preparation. Some listeners may be more familiar with NCATE, which is CAPE's forerunner. But CAPE, the single national accreditor of teacher education programs in the U.S., also put into place, and these stand now, so these are in place right now as we speak, new accountability regulations that required programs to show that their graduates were effective in the sense that they had an impact on students' achievement, usually defined in terms of their performance on test, on standardized test. So that gives you, that's two examples of my point about multiple and layered on top of one another accountability initiatives. Our argument in the book is that these multiple accountability initiatives, and there are others I could mention, are different from one another. But in certain ways, they're similar enough that we were able to identify what we called a dominant accountability paradigm that shared certain values and foundational ideas that defined the problem of teacher education as a policy issue in similar ways, and that had similar perspectives on power and control, which we may say more about as we continue.
Following up on that, what do these approaches to education reform demonstrate about their advocates' attitudes regarding power and control?
Well, I think one of the most important things that most of these accountability initiatives are based on in terms of power and control is mistrust of teacher education and of teaching as professions. And so they think that the way to solve, quote, the problem of teacher education is by putting into place standards and policies and processes and ways of evaluating that move toward more compliance and more standardization of teacher education programs. So there is this tendency toward control from outside of local teacher education programs and outside of the institutions and programs and the local communities they work with. Many people have suggested that this is part of deprofessionalization. So teacher educators have fewer and fewer opportunities to make their own decisions, to use professional judgment, to work with communities, to be sure that what they're doing in their programs reflects the knowledge traditions and the cultural and linguistic resources of the communities that their candidates and graduates are working with. So in general, in terms of power and control, what we have thought of as this dominant accountability paradigm tends to be an external look or an external imposition of regulations wherein the people who have to put the regulations into effect, the people who are the target or the object of the regulations, have had very, very little say in what those regulations are. So they've had very little opportunity to participate in decisions about how teacher education programs will be evaluated. So this power and control is external, it's imposed, And it, as I said at the beginning, it seems to be based on mistrust of teacher educators. That's not a very good recipe for effective program improvement or for bringing about real change.
So is there any evidence at all that framing accountability and school improvement in this way is effective in bringing about those desired changes?
What my colleagues and I concluded in the policy brief that we did for NEPC was that there was actually very little evidence that these various accountability initiatives would actually lead to program improvement. We found that most of these initiatives had findings or results that were kind of at a very broad level and not at a level that is conducive to program improvement. And even some of the people who advocate for some of these have admitted this won't really lead to program improvement. So we came to the conclusion that there was very thin evidence that these accountability initiatives were actually going to be effective. The way we did that, if I could give one example, was we took a number of the most prominent accountability initiatives that have been put into place in the U.S. over the last 10 years. We looked at them and we unpacked them in the sense of what kind of claims do they make as accountability initiatives. And then we said, is there evidence that those claims that are made will actually have an impact on the improvement of teacher education, since that's the whole point. So NCTQ, which is the National Council for Teacher Quality, which is a private advocacy organization that was originally funded and founded by the conservative Fordham Foundation, is a good example. They have been, since 2013, evaluating teacher preparation programs, and many people know this with their very first reports. They published them jointly with U.S. News and World Report. Now, we unpacked what are the basic claims underlying these NCTQ reports that, what are the claims they make about how this is going to lead to improved teacher education programs, improved teacher education quality. And we came to the conclusion that they essentially made two claims. One was a market claim and one was an effectiveness claim. The market claim was that what they were going to do, especially by highly publicizing their findings through U.S. News and World Report, was to do what they called shine a harsh spotlight on this uneven field of teacher education. They said the field is very uneven in terms of quality, and the only thing that's going to make a difference is if we can unleash the full force of the market. So the idea was teacher candidates and programs would vote with their feet. If a program wasn't rated highly in terms of their rankings, people wouldn't choose to go there. That was the assumption. That's the market claim. The effectiveness claim is that NCTQ is an effective way to rank programs. So if you have a higher ranking, according to NCTQ, the assumption is that means you're a better program. Now, we looked at the evidence for both of those claims, and to make a long story short, we found that in terms of the market claim, there was very limited evidence that these kinds of ranking systems, especially set up in the way NCTQ's is set up, actually have an impact on program quality. And in fact, some of the ranking systems seem to encourage institutions to sort of game the system. So they might do things to increase their ranking, but not necessarily to increase quality. And then in terms of effectiveness, we found that there is virtually no evidence to suggest that candidates from institutions that have higher NCTQ ratings actually perform better in the classroom. So there's some research where they looked at the value added scores of graduates and then compared that with the rankings of their institutions. And there was no support for that. So we, without going into detail about the other ones, we found similar situations of thin evidence that these various accountability initiatives and the theories of the theory of action that they assumed was really going to have an impact on program improvement.
It sounds as though there's some pretty serious problems with this approach to teacher education accountability. Are there things that we risk by pursuing it, by not really kind of attending to kind of a broader variety of issues tied into education?
I think there actually are, and I think those risks are pretty serious. One is the thing that I was just talking about, the idea that we don't really have much evidence that these accountability approaches actually lead to program improvement, even if you define program improvement in the narrow way that these accountability initiatives do. But beyond that, some other issues that I think are really worth mentioning. There's been a fair amount of evidence that these kinds of accountability initiatives actually narrow the curriculum. We know that from K-12 education. We know that that was one of the impacts of the kind of testing that was required with No Child Left Behind, that people tended to focus on what was going to be tested. It narrowed the curriculum and it pushed out many kinds of things that we would want to have in the curriculum. So in teacher education, it may be that there is no room for talking about democratic goals, democratic education, for example, in teacher education, that there isn't much room for talking about goals about students' well-being or their social and emotional development as goals of teacher education, as part of the way we want to prepare people to teach. Because we're too busy focusing on just these things that are going to be evaluated with these accountability systems. One critic said that these kinds of narrow foci tend to deform rather than reform teacher education. Another problem and concern is that even in programs where there is a social justice or an equity focus, what many teacher educators were finding as these various accountability initiatives were put into place was that teacher candidates tended to just put aside their social justice goals or their equity goals while they were working on doing well enough to pass some kind of assessment. They just, what one critic said, left their social justice beliefs at the door and focused on passing the teacher performance assessment, for example, that they were required to pass in a particular state in order to be certified as a beginning teacher. So there are lots of problems of this sort. The accountability initiatives aren't effective. They don't have evidence to support them, even though they want teacher education reforms to be evidence-based, supposedly. And they just push out of the teacher education curriculum many, many other goals related to teaching and the preparation of teachers that my colleagues and I think are really important as goals in a democratic society.
So in your book that you and your associates will be publishing in the coming weeks, you present an alternative to the now dominant teacher education accountability paradigm. Can you describe this alternative?
Yes, we're calling this alternative democratic accountability in teacher education. We're certainly not the only and not the first people to focus on democracy and democratic education as an important part of teacher education. But what we're trying to do is say, even though we've said there are all these problems with accountability and the accountability initiatives that dominate the field, and even though we've identified what's wrong with this dominant accountability paradigm, we don't think that we have to reject accountability as a lever for change. And as a matter of fact, we think that a different kind of accountability could help us change the terms of the debate, could help us reconstruct the goals and purposes of teacher education, and could really bring us to a different place. So with democratic accountability in teacher education, we're talking about the basic values underlying accountability being preparing teachers to prepare kids to live and work in a democratic society, which means they have to learn how to engage in democratic deliberation. And we need that now more than ever in our society when we have so many divides among people and so many points of contention. So we're arguing for democratic deliberation as a basic skill and for students, and therefore as a basic part of teacher education. We're also, another foundational idea is the notion of strong equity. And by that we mean not just believing that if everybody has a better teacher, that will exacerbate inequity and inequality, that teachers are a part of that, but they're not the only part. And so that means teachers being activists who work with other community groups, who work with other reformers to try to change the structures and systems of society that produce and reproduce inequities. We also talk about intelligent professional responsibility as opposed to externally imposed accountability requirements. So we're saying the teacher educators and the communities and families they work with and serve have to be part of the groups who have input into what teacher education programs are held accountable for. So that's another central part of our idea of democratic accountability in teacher education. And we contrast it directly with the dominant accountability paradigm.
In our last minute or so, do you have any suggestions or things that policymakers could potentially do to move away from our current accountability paradigm to one more grounded in the democratic ideals of this country?
I think one of the most important things they need to do is stop focusing only on test scores. Many of these accountability initiatives have reified test scores as the way to define effective teaching. And as a matter of fact, that was very, very clear in the Race to the Top legislation that built on No Child Left Behind and really exacerbated that whole approach. So, and there is some change along these lines, but looking at multiple ways of understanding teacher effectiveness is one of the most important things that I think they can do. And then understanding that teacher quality is not the only factor in the economic health of the nation. It's part of it, but it's not the only thing. And we need to look much more broadly to understand the bigger picture.
Many thanks, Marilyn, for sharing your thoughts about this timely and important topic. This is Greg Smith for the National Education Policy Center. May's Education Interview of the Month will be with Dr. Michael Barber at Touro University in California and Dr. Brian Mann at the University of Alabama, two researchers who have been studying virtual schools in the United States. We invite you to join us for our final podcast of the academic year.